Hello, welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, a new series for BBC Two about 1.5 million people where work is no longer a way out of poverty. And that's the same number as the unemployed. So we're nearly at the stage where we've got as many people in work poverty as out of work. And Arabella Wynne-Hughes, she's just arrived in Bristol from Hungary. What does she make of our city? And the final episode of Sky TV's Inside the Freemasons. What are an ex-Freemason's final conclusions? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, I'll give details at the end of the show. Now I'm joined on the line by Shell Coe, who's from Keogh Films. They're making a film for BBC Two at the moment. Shell, do you want to start just by telling me what is the idea behind this new film project you're doing?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. So we're working this year what we hope will be a landmark BBC Two series, four parts about hardworking men and women across the country who, despite their best efforts, are struggling to make ends meet. And that can be in a range of professions. It can be absolutely anything. And we've been quite shocked already in some of the research we've done visiting various food banks around the country. And we've come across nurses, police officers, all sorts of people, drivers. And it just really feels like everywhere in all the four corners of the UK and in all different professions, people are just finding it really difficult to keep their head above water. So we're interested in telling a range of different stories, trying to explore what it's like to sort of survive on low income in Britain today. And I think it's coming at a good time with all that's going on in sort of the political backdrop with various cuts, rises in prices. And obviously we'll be putting it in context, but at this stage, we're really just looking to hear from people and hear their personal experiences of how they're finding life in Britain on low income today.
It's a big topic, isn't it? And I think the other thing is, I mean, I can remember, well, I'm in my mid-50s now, I can remember where actually, when I left school, you could pretty much, in the 70s, you could pretty much just waltz into out of one job and into another one. Nowadays, it's not anywhere near that easy.
I know. And there's so many things that are making it hard for people. And I think some of the most heartbreaking things is that people often, there's a lot of guilt that and blame that goes with it and that people put on themselves. But there's so many things outside of people's control. And now, obviously, you've got the 0-hour contracts, you know, rising. I mean, just people trying to manage debt, rising rent prices, trying to sort of navigate the welfare and benefit system. And I think there's obviously something, some sort of flaw in the system, because there's just so many people struggling. So we're kind of trying to really speak to that 1.7 million people that are finding it difficult in Britain today and sort of living on or below the breadline.
You know what? It sounds great. What you're doing effectively is trying to actually find specific examples, because these statistics, when you talk about 1.7 million people, you can kind of lose your mind thinking about those 1.7 million if you don't actually see specific examples. But, you know, there's another thing which occurs to me, and that's that if we're talking about sort of 60 years ago, 50 years ago, even 40 years ago, it wasn't really necessary for both partners to go out to work to earn enough money to pay a mortgage or pay the rent, and now it is.
Absolutely. I think the pressures on people today is just astronomical. It's just, I think people find it just really hard to keep up, and that's what we want to hear about. We want to hear what it is, you know, on a daily, on a weekly basis, what are those hard choices you're having to make for yourself and your family. You know, already I've been hearing stories of people, it even comes down to things like, you know, choosing between paying the rent and putting food on the table. And it's just, it's really heartbreaking hearing people's stories of when it's their kids' birthdays and those, you know, just the difficult decisions they've got to make about whether they can, you know, buy a present or whether it's about putting food in the fridge. That's really what it's coming to.
I mean, it's awful, isn't it? When you people are having to use their credit cards to pay the rent, for example, and then they're told by the bank, oh, sorry, your credit limit has disappeared from, say, £5,000 down to £200 this month. And then how are they going to pay the rent? These are the sorts of things people are facing day after day, and often in isolation. So it's great what you're doing, Cheryl. I think you're actually saying, well, hang on a minute, you're not in isolation anymore. We want the eyes of BBC and the world to be looking at you and showing that, you know, there are people out there that are concerned about this. So how do people get in touch anyway?
Well, so at this stage, because obviously we know it is a big undertaking. And I think also when you're going through something, when you're sort of juggling and you've got like difficult financial situations, it can be a bit daunting sort of talking about these things. But there's no commitment to be part of the series at first. And we're definitely not rushing into this. You know, we're not going to be turning up on anyone's doorstep with a camera. We'd just love to have a chat. So if you feel like this is something that's speaking to you, that you're like, you're doing your best and you're struggling, and maybe you're in employment or you've recently been in employment, maybe you've been made redundant recently, or you're looking for work, then we'd just love to hear from you. And you can either get in touch directly. I've got a mobile number, which is 07465 733 735, or if you'd rather get in touch via email, that's shell.co, so shell.coe at keofilms.com. And we just love to hear from you. You know, whatever your story is, if you're a nurse, police officer, driver, you work in a shop, whatever your story is, if you just feel like on a regular basis you're having to make hard choices for yourself and your family, and you're really just finding it really, really tough to sort of get by, then please give us a call. We'd just like to hear your story. Take it from there.
I mean, it actually can help, I think. Seriously, can help to pour your heart out, because for some people this is something that they feel ashamed of and they actually bottle it up inside. But look, for those that are worried about, like, who is this person, who is Keo Films, you've just been involved, I know, in making some interesting films recently, and Keo won a BAFTA, didn't they, at the recent BAFTA Awards for this film Exodus about the migrants and the refugees. Also, there's
That's
one about
right.
about the miners too. So what's your track record like?
I mean, so it's a brilliant company. I mean, they've just got such a strong moral background, a long history of making powerful and sensitively produced films on social issues, mostly for the BBC. And yes, you're very right. We're very excited to have won the BAFTA this week for Best Factual Series. That was Exodus, Our Journey to Europe, which followed migrant stories from a variety of different countries. And I think the reason it was really well received and respected is that the filmmakers really took their time to get to know the people making those journeys and really trusted them as well to sort of own those journeys. So whereas often you have an external person commentating, I think they really fought to let them sort of take control of their journeys. Because these are some like incredible journeys that people are making. I mean, really just astonishing, the kind of bravery and resilience involved. And it felt right to sort of let them own their own stories, and we hope to do justice as well to the stories that we're trying to tell in this program similarly. And we also we made another series last year, Last Miners, which is a two-part documentary following the workers at Kellingley Colliery in North Yorkshire as it prepares to close. So again, really like human stories, really sort of looking at different people's personal journeys. And I think in what we're trying to do with this new series, it will be very much in the detail. And we hope to tell some inspiring stories about what's going on in Britain today amidst, obviously, what is a real sort of difficult state of the nation, a real crisis. So that's a bit about Keo Films.
Also, you talking about the miners, I have to mention we've got this place over in South Wales, not far from us here in Bristol, called Big Pit. Because South Wales, of course, the valleys used to be a massive mining area, producing, you know, incredible amounts of coal between the wars up until the 1970s, 1980s. Coal strikes and the slow shutdown of the coal industry. But, you know, Big Pit has been kept open as a museum. And when I was up there last year, I had a chat to some of the miners. There were two sides, really. One of them was saying, well, actually, it was really backbreaking, dirty, horrible work in the dark every day, and I'm glad it's finished. But there was another guy I spoke to had a completely different point of view. He said, well, we fought for decades to get good conditions down our mines. You know, my father, my grandfather here fought through the unions to make sure that the safety was absolutely top-notch, that if there was any kind of hint of it, there being any kind of safety problem, they would close everything down. They'd send, robots in and all that sort of thing. We had the best and the safest mines in the world. And then they closed them down after all that time and effort. And he said, I was gutted when they closed them down because we thought that we'd fought for all this and then suddenly it was all for nothing. And they were importing this cheap coal from other parts of the world where the safety procedures were nowhere, were nothing. So what did you find in the miners series? Were they pleased it was being closed down? Because, you know, it's a tough job being a miner.
I think despite the hardship, I don't know. I think whatever your trade, whether you're a black cab driver or a nurse, there's passion there. You know, you believe in what you do, don't you? And I think it is the end of an era, despite it being tough. I think the director actually of that series is on this new project. And I know he mentioned that the team spirit was something that really, that sort of sense of community, it's something very special there, that kind of bond that you share with your co-workers. And I think coming out into the world, you've then got to reestablish that and you've got to re-find your place. So there's a lot to be gained from starting a new phase, but I think it would be wrong to say that you didn't lose something too.
Also, I think, just a bit of a plug for Big Pit, if people want to go over there on the train or on the M4, well worth a visit. Absolutely fascinating to see how things used to be done. But look, Shell Co from Keo Films, thanks very much for joining us. And also, just to repeat your number, it's 07465 733 735, and it's Shell, SHELL.COE at keofilms.com. I hope I've got that right, didn't I?
You have. And thank you so much for having me on. So if anyone wants to meet, to have a chat, if they'd rather do it in person, please give me a call. Happy to come meet you. Otherwise, if you want to do it at a later date, we can always pop back. So we're just not rushing into this. We're happy to take our time. But do get in touch, because we'd love to hear from you.
And I'll tell you what, if people were interested but they didn't manage to get those details down, I'll repeat those email address and the phone number for Shell at the end of the show.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined now by Arabella Wynne-Hughes. Arabella, you've just got here in Bristol. You were living in Hungary. Have you been here for a month? What do you make of the city?
I've really enjoyed my time here this far. It's a really big contrast coming from Budapest to Bristol, and there's lots of things that I'm not quite sure I understand, but it's a really interesting place because of its cultural heritage and because of the people.
Well, give us some of your first impressions. I think most of us have been here a while, so for someone who's just arrived, it's nice to see. What do you make of the place when you first arrive?
Well, the first thing coming from Budapest, I came to work and just find any job because in Budapest I didn't really find anything that paid decent money. So if you come here from Eastern Europe, every shop corner, every restaurant has a sign looking for people to work in, and there's so many recruitment agencies. And then you've got your job centre as well, who's there to help you. So compared to Hungary, you come here and there's an abundance of possibilities.
So what about, have you had any time for social life?
Yes, definitely. Lots of social life as well. But I live quite a relaxed life, so it's more just going to the parks with friends and photography. I love photography.
Oh, right, so. Yes. You're saying you're doing a bit of photography. What got you interested in that to begin with?
I've been doing photography for a long time, and it's just something my dad gave me my camera, and I've been doing it for 10 years, so it's quite a nice journey to sort of deepen your knowledge in and see how it reflects your life.
Have you been commissioned? Are people picking up your photographic work much?
Yeah, they are. I try to... With photography, it's not about money. It's about passion and expression and just... cultivating myself, really. So I try not to do any work that would undermine that and make my own choices with that. So if you want to make your own choice and have that freedom, then usually it's...
So what do you choose to take pictures of then?
I've got lots of different projects running, so they're long-term projects. One of the reasons why I came to Bristol as well was to just... have a refreshed view on life as well, to notice those little details that you would want to notice with the photography that I'm doing, and definitely this difference in culture and sentiment and people that I enjoy.
Okay, so the difference, what's Hungary like to grow up in? If, you know, for somebody here, how would you paint Hungary as a place to grow up? What's the difference?
Well, it's quite different because of Hungary's national heritage, you know, because of socialism. There's a lot of traces of socialism that still remain today, and there's a lot of new things that have been picked up in the last 30 years as well.
So, right, that 30 years is pretty much since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that was when you were very young, I imagine. But, you know, so what have you seen actually going on, and how's that expressed itself in Hungary, the sort of post-Soviet country?
Well, it hasn't necessarily developed quite, because we just end up in the same type of government, making the same mistakes over and over again and not really developing as a nation in a whole. And the problems that have been underlying since forever, they're still there, and it's just not getting solved. And
so when you say the problems, underlying problems, what do you mean? Is this just like the state trying to provide things, not provide things, or what?
Yes,
is socialism not working over there? Oh, corruption, okay.
Definitely, right. So there's an underlying corruption, and it's not necessarily about the system. Here, I think, in the UK, it's very much... corruption does affect who you are as a person as well, maybe, but in Hungary, it affects that person much more, because even if you wouldn't want to be corrupt, if you want to survive, there has to be some kind of bending of rules somewhere, because otherwise it's just not possible.
And what about something as simple as education? How would you compare the education you got in Hungary, the sort of thing people will get here?
Yeah, so the education is quite a big question right now, because the government that's in power in Hungary has changed a lot of the foundation of the education now, and now that it's a bit of, to me, in my perspective, I come from a very liberal background and from a very liberal education, for me it's a brainwashing a bit in terms of how religion affects upbringing as well, how much religious studies they're in, what's the perspective that they're showing things.
So what do they want, more religious studies or less?
More religious studies,
okay.
Definitely.
Because I imagine maybe in the
studies.
Soviet time, that was completely cut out. I mean, the Soviet era, they didn't really like religion, did they?
Yes, that's true. That's when there were no religious studies. But now we're more in a pro sort of Russia and a pro family, very conventional family, a bit...
Is it fair to say it's a bit of a backlash, you know, so maybe completely squashing the religion, now people say, well, that was wrong, we're going to go back in the other direction and maybe going too far?
Well, maybe, but you see, there's a lot of, you know, the bigger family you have, the more benefits you get from the government, per se. So it's, so you are better off if you have a bigger family, so everything's going into that direction.
Yeah, so the government probably just wants people to have lots of kids.
Yeah.
But the country can't afford it, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why there was a big problem with the migrant crisis. And when Hungary closed down its borders and didn't allow any of the migrants through, that was quite debatable, because the population of Hungary is decreasing. And we could have had or welcomed migrants.
So, I mean, have people got money in their pockets in Hungary to go out for the evening in Budapest?
It's quite strange, but generally not so much. No, I mean, it's not so much about the money in the pocket, but it's about the security, the welfare of security, and how it enables you to do to think more freely with more possibilities. So if every day you're thinking, you know, if every day you're struggling, it will, you know, it will really affect your life on long term.
But you've not just been in Hungary, have you? You've been travelling around a lot. The Amazon, what brought you there?
The Amazon, yes. I was travelling in Brazil. I went to Brazil because I was interested in the culture. My education, my academic education is in theatre, and there's and theatre and the culture, and especially then in 2014, it was the World Cup, sorry. And so there was lots of things happening culturally there, and I thought that there was lots of just interesting things happening culturally and theatre-wise. And there's also this theatre practitioner called Augusto Ball, and he did sort of extreme theatre education thing. And so I was looking at that as well. And then in the Amazon, there's an amazing opera just in the middle of the Amazon. There's a city and there's an opera, and I really wanted to see that as well. So it was 7 months, but...
Crikey. That's a long time to spend out in Brazil.
Yes, just the first top half.
Wow. and the Amazon itself is pretty much cut off, isn't it, from civilization? A lot of parts around there and rainforests and small places where tribal people, because I think, if I remember from what I know about Brazil, is that although most of the activity goes on in some parts of the country, this whole Amazon area is pretty much cut off in a lot of ways.
So, yeah, exactly. It is cut off. So there's imagine the Amazon running into the Atlantic Ocean on the east side, and then if you want to go into the interior, that's how you call it on the continent, inwards, anything from the coast is the interior. Then there's either the boat, and that's a very poor person's way of travelling, or plane, but there's no direct or goods.
Right, so there's no coaches,
no cars, no nothing. So it's either a very poor person's journey, or you can afford to fly. And then there's one city, Manaus, where there was in the World Cup, England played, or Britain, sorry. And so you go to that city, and then further on, there's nowhere.
So what did you see there?
So there, it's also a very interesting dynamics of this... you know, this sort of going there, and the indigenous people who have been kind of affected over the years, and who have evolved as a culture, and it's interesting how this culture has evolved, and how a lot of the American effects have or not American as such, but Western, you know, how much they love new things, technology, not
right. So they're kind of seduced a bit by all the glitz of our technology.
Yes, and not necessarily valuing the old things as much. And then there's a lack of understanding, you know, things like trash, you know, like they think the Amazon is just like a big something that will swallow up all the plastic, but it's not.
Yeah, they throw it in the Amazon, it just disappears then.
But it doesn't. So it's, and then of course there's lots of poverty. People are really, really poor, and but they're fine. Like they live in the nature, so I don't know if they're fine. Maybe they're not fine. I don't know. But you know, they're really poor.
They don't have a lot of stuff. I mean, I can remember I travelled in South America a bit just to find that the peasants who have very little except a little bit of land, actually some of them seem quite content because at least they've got somewhere to live. They don't have to pay any rent to anybody for it, and they may have only one room to live in, but they seem quite sort of at ease with themselves in a way that people in the West sort of a bit anxious. Oh gosh, you know, I've got to get the next paycheck.
Exactly,
blah, blah, blah.
It's a completely different style of living. And it's easygoing, so you do just live day by day, and it is a very simple life. So when we're talking about rich and poor, I don't mean they are poor. I mean they are poor in a financial sense, but not necessarily in a spiritual or in the way they live their lives. I think maybe they are much more fulfilled than a lot of us are here.
Have they got reasonable, you know, security, food security, so they can eat or not? You know, I don't know.
I mean, they live in the jungle. I mean, I lived in the jungle. I lived in a community in the jungle, quite isolated for 3 months. And yeah, I mean, there is 30, 40 different types of fruit and veg.
Living, oh, right. So you've got a kind of great big load of agriculture just sort of hanging around you.
Yeah, you've got the coconut, the banana, the pineapple, the papaya, the mango. Yeah.
Also, Israel and the Mediterranean you've been to.
Yes.
So the Mediterranean is sailing, is it?
It was with a caravan, with my family, with my dad and my sister. And it was a long time. It was in the year 2000, because it was before the wars broke out, the recent wars, when it was still calm.
Right, before Tony Blair and George Bush.
Exactly, yeah. Before that period. It was and it was quite nice, because it was just that window of time that you know, do it now, then never again. So it was, you know, Israel's quite a small country. We always talk about Israel in terms of like war and bloodshed, but it's actually quite a small country that's easy to travel around, and it's a short amount of time. So if you really want to get to know it and see its attractions.
Did you see the apartheid there, the sort of difference between the one side and the other?
Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of people anyway now say it's, you know, there's a real racial separation in Israel.
Yeah, definitely. And it was quite interesting, because for the first 2 weeks we stayed with a Jewish family in Haifa, and in the last 2 weeks we stayed outside of Jerusalem with an Arab family. And it was quite funny, because the family in Jerusalem, we didn't know before that. We were just traveling in the caravan and asked whether we could hook up the caravan to some electricity and water. And my dad, it was just the three of us, and I was maybe 10 or 12 and my sister was 14. And my dad is quite a bit older. There's 60 years between us, so he might have been maybe 70 or 72 or 74. So we were always quite loved by, you know, it's quite a nice image of a family, if there's like, I think about it that way. So everybody always took care of us in that sense. So it would be, they were these orchards that we asked if we could stay there, and it turned out to be like a big, beautiful family of maybe 20, 30 people. Wow. Working there all the time. It was nice. They brought us fresh fruit every morning. Great friends.
Well, look, you've kind of inspired me, and I hope some of the listeners too, to travel a bit. What do you think you've got out of your travelling? Because you've done quite a bit, haven't you?
What I got out of the travelling right now is that I would like to stay in one place for a while.
You've had enough of it. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, Arabella Wynne-Hughes, fascinating talking to you. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined on the line again now by Ian Matteson, who's a former Freemason. But you, Ian, have been watching this series on Monday evenings, every Monday at 8 p.m. on Sky One, called Inside the Freemasons. Now, as an ex-Freemason yourself, now the series is finished, what do you make of it?
Well, I think basically it's a bit of an advert for Freemasonry, as far as I can see. I've looked at a lot more on the internet, and I've had several books for a long time, and I've come to a conclusion that, you know, at the beginning of every program they go through a sort of the standard opening where they say that they're going to lift the veil of secrecy, and in no way has that veil of secrecy been lifted in these five programs. They've skillfully managed to tell us about a nice organization that majors on charity and fellowship and brotherly love and all these sort of things. That's not exclusive in itself, and that doesn't reveal anything to anybody. We see them all in their various regalia, of course, which gives them the air of a decent, you know, organization. But the veil of secrecy is still there. That's where I've come to it all. There's no balanced view. If there was a balanced view, then the rituals were not private, but they were revealed to everybody, then people can make up their mind as to what it's like. At the moment, we've got an organization that appears very benign. The people in it seem very, very jolly. And by the way, I've recognized quite a few people in the shows and worked with some of them. But I think it doesn't major on some of the problems that Freemasonry has caused.
Okay, well, look, you're talking about balance. If you had the opportunity in that series, did they actually have anybody who was, say, an ex-Freemason like yourself, or someone who's a critic of Freemasonry to provide that balance? You saying no, now is your opportunity. What would you have been saying as part of that program if you'd actually had the opportunity? Well, I'm just wondering if there were moments where you thought, well, hang on, they've just completely skirted around that.
They were never going to in the first place. They wouldn't be allowed to by the very rules that they set, by the very obligations that one takes in the different degrees. There is no way that they would allow anybody on that program to be critical. If I was invited onto that program, I would want to see the rituals in full. I've looked on the internet quite a few times. There are a few black and white sort of film rituals, some of it. There was, on these programs, some of the ritual was shown, the very benign parts, the parts that made them sound rather good. But there was nowhere, description of what type of obligation that a Mason has to take and what he's committing to make himself do. And in the last program, one of the Masons there is quoted as saying, well, he says it himself, is that you don't join Masonry short term. You join for life. You don't get out of it. I think I mentioned last time, it's a bit more like Hotel California, the song. You know, you can go in there, you can never leave. Check out any time you want, but never leave. And that's true. And if that's still in people's heads, when those of us who've left the Freemasonry, if we were allowed to be left alone by them, then that would be fine. But they don't, because anybody considered leaving is considered to be a very bad person. And so really in these programs, they wouldn't tolerate anybody criticizing them.
But hang on.
Actually exposing what they're really saying.
Okay, hang on. But I mean, how can they make you not leave? I mean, what would they do to persuade you to stay if they thought that you were thinking of leaving?
I've seen somebody who stood up and he said he was going to be leaving the lodge because of his faith. Didn't allow him. He'd come to his conclusion with his conscience, etc. And there were many people who were trying to go and persuade him afterwards. But that was done out of lodge. Probably his sponsor, his seconder, maybe his father or a close person would have gone and tried to speak to him. And if they do then leave, it's if you come across them again and people find out about you that you're an ex-Mason, you suddenly become a pariah. You're not worthy. You must be rotten. You must have left for a wrong reason, or you must have been chucked out for a wrong reason. And therefore you are, per se, from that moment onwards, one of the great unwashed. You're not one of life's decent
people
anymore.
You've touched on something fascinating there, because you're implying that when people join Freemasonry, when they go through these initiation rites, rituals, whatever you want to call them, they don't realise what they're getting into. So they're being asked to join something with these various oaths, you must do this, you will do this, but without realising what they're getting into. Is that fair to say?
That is very, very fair to say. And of course, when you're thinking about it and you come out after those meetings, and perhaps you think about it a little bit later on, and you want to ask questions of people, why are we saying this? Why are we doing that? The answers generally you get is, look, I've been through it. So-and-so's been through it. Look at all the famous people who have been through it. Look at all the top people who have been through it. And they've survived and they're okay. You know, what's wrong? And so they don't actually explain it. They defend it and say, well, you know, everybody's okay. You know, we haven't lost two arms, two legs. We're still there. So it must be okay. And that's how it's done. Whenever I ask questions, even in my early life, about the ritual, about what I've just said, I got those answers from people like my father, my uncles, other people who, they never really answered that question, only on the basis of, look, I've been through it, I'm okay, so carry on, don't worry about it. And of course you do worry about it. And again, I'm doing my research, there's lots of people who have come to the conclusion that their faith, whatever that is, has not allowed them, is incompatible with Freemasonry.
Now, look, I mean, we touched on this last time, Ian, but also, I mean, the Freemasons themselves would say at this point, they'll say, well, we welcome all faiths and none.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things. They welcome them, but the Catholic Church, for instance, excommunicated people who became Masons. They decided that only changed in 1983 with a slight change of wording to say that if a Catholic joins Freemasonry in his normal church, when he goes to church on a Sunday or during the week, he is not allowed to have communion. And that, you know, in terms of a church, that's quite a big thing. So, you know, the church is what the church says about it. There are plenty of Christians who have read the Bible and don't like the fact that the Masonic ritual is taken, in a lot of their stories, taken straight out of the Holy Bible. That's the Holy Bible of the Christian and the Judeo people, remember, not the Islamic one, but the ritual is still the same, even if somebody of non-Christian faith comes and joins Freemasonry.
Now, there's a little bit of the Sermon on the Mount from Jesus comes to me now, Ian, and that is what, as part of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus actually says, never swear an oath, simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. So I suppose he's saying you shouldn't really swear, I swear, I promise you that I'm telling you the truth. You should just tell the truth. And that's actually the oaths that Jesus is saying, don't swear them. That's a fundamental part of the hierarchy of Freemasonry, if I understand it correctly.
Oh, absolutely, yes. You have to swear the oaths at each degree that you go through. But the fundamental one is always the first one. And the one that binds you into the whole thing is that first one. Because all the other ones are just variations on that first one. And those type of things, if they were put in on show, if they were allowed to be filmed and put on there and say, right, and a balance program came up and said, right, this is what they actually do in the first degree, right from the beginning to the end, don't close the doors, then let people make their minds up. That's what I say. I could say that I, you know, in reviewing this as an ex-Mason, I could have lots of things, you know, lots of things against it. Of course, I'm an ex-Mason, therefore I've got some things to say about it. But I want a balanced view. I wanted to see a balanced view. I've seen lots of views on Masonry on the internet and in books, etc. And I could go on really on one side of the thing, completely the other side. I want to see a balanced view. And there is somebody out there, surely, will take on the task of putting that balanced view in a proper film for people to see.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was a film called, I think it was just called Inside the Brotherhood, which was made for Granada TV back in the 1980s, which goes into all sorts of things like the political implications of having metropolitan police lodges in Scotland Yard, for example. So yes. Particularly as we found out during the phone hacking scandal, that there were senior police who were Freemasons who were using the Masonic lodges to get stories and then get these stories to the Sun, the News of the World, more particularly. But anyway, so there is the potential, anyway, for Masonic lodges to be used for criminal activity. I suppose, you know, it's probably true to say most organisations, but that seemed to be a bit taboo, that people didn't... Well, I mean, there does seem to be a bit of a taboo still, Ian, around Freemasonry. Is that fair?
I think it is fair. And they're not doing anything, even in all these shows and these particular programs, that didn't do anything to allay certain people's fears about it all. It might have made them look at this thing as a, this organization as a fairly benign one, a very charitable one, that looking after each other, etc. Again, which is nothing new. There's lots of other organizations out there. But it never lifted that veil, which is what people wanted to see, I'm sure. Maybe that it's still the attraction that people want to go into Masonry. Maybe it is the secrecy that they want the craving part of. I could make an argument for that, very much so, because we all love to be able to, I mean, how many times you as a young child, and you know, kid growing up, etc., I know something that you don't, you know, and there's a little bit of pride inside you that says that you know something else that somebody doesn't. You're a little bit better. And this is taking it to a, you know, at the ultimate level, is that if I know something, this I'm part of this organization, and therefore, and they're told, you're told in the ritual that you are given a token and a word, which is a handshake, etc., that will distinguish you from the rest of the world. So you're encouraged to think that you are a better person than the rest of the world. And those people who aren't in it, perhaps are ignorant, those people who leave it, are really pariahs.
Okay, so what about the last couple of episodes? What have you seen in those?
Didn't see anything more in terms of, you know, a lot. They just majored on the fact that a lot of lodges are being. They actually did admit a lot of lodges have been closing in the last number of years. But they then major on a lodge that actually opened. It was a football lodge, which is showing that these lodges that do form are specialist type lodges. And that's nothing new. We heard about it on a few programs ago. And there are lodges for schools. They also majored on the last program. They majored on a university lodge. What they're trying to do in their advert on the last program is that there's Oxford University has a lodge, and they're trying to encourage young Oxford graduates or Oxford students to join the lodge.
So does that include girls?
No, Masonry is, you know, Freemasonry as per the United Grand Lodge of England does not recognise any female Freemasonry. There is female Freemasonry in the, there's an international organisation of co-Freemasonry. It's based in Surbiton. And if you go down between Surbiton and Kingston, it's on the main road. You can see the sign for the building. What struck me, though, is when the university student was interviewed, he was then given an explanation of how much it would cost him. Now, even though he's a student, remember, it's going to cost him so much per annum, then so much contribution to Provincial Grand Lodge and so much contribution to Grand Lodge, and then there are dining fees, and that's without wine, and you need wine as well, always a dining fee. So it's quite an expensive hobby, as if you like to call it. But when you see some of them, and I saw a couple of the masters there showing that they were in four or five lodges. And when you also, when you become a very good ritualist type mason, you start to get invited to other lodges. And so you can be out 6-7 days a week in this. And there are people I've known who are dedicated masons, and they make it their life. And in fact, there was one of the chaps on the last program who said that he loved Freemasonry. He was part of it. He doesn't know what he would have done without Freemasonry, what sort of person he would be. Well, I did then work it out, and they said that there's 200,000 Freemasons in England, which is something like 1.3% of the population of male, that is. So I'm pleased to say 98.7% of the male population in England are not Freemasons, and that's more pleasing.
Well, look, I mean, let's go back to this whole business of excluding women. I mean, that just seems a bit archaic in the 21st century. Why is it, do you think, that the Masons don't come in for more flack? I mean, one would have thought that, men as well as women should be making a fuss about this. Why is it that the women can't join?
When you listen to, and I listen to the people in the program, the ladies in the program, they were very much akin to supporting their partners. not wanting to get involved, and it's only his hobby let him go.
So, I mean, I'm wondering, were there any, you know, sort of Germaine Greer or someone else in this programme saying, well, hang on a minute, this is archaic and putting the other point of view?
No, there was none of that. It was very supportive. And if you then sort of take that a little further about the people who can become Masons, well, of course, anybody can become a Mason. But if you have a look at the program, etc., all the people in the those lodges, etc., were, should we say, better off than your average worker, and the chances of promotion and merit, etc., go up. Or it does depend on your personal circumstances, because if you can afford to go along, if you can afford to take further offices, if you can afford to buy the more and more expensive regalia, etc., then yes, you are going to be chosen to get promoted and go up the ladder.
So, I mean, this is one aspect. I wonder what you make of it, that why people join Freemasonry. You know, there is, first of all, there's the ostensible reason, oh, it's just a kind of friendly club. But then there is the other one, which is potentially here is a route to privilege above the rest of society and promotion in your job and getting contracts, for example, if you're running a business already, getting, you know, extending that business.
I would say that's not a major thing, and I'll be perfectly honest in that, to say that is far beyond the ideas of anybody going in, and they've said so in their programs that it's not for personal gain, etc. However, when you get in there, when you become part of an old boys' lodge, a regimental lodge, a police lodge, etc., once you're in amongst a group of like-minded individuals. And I think that program that you mentioned in the 60s that was put out, there were people of the same ilk in the lodges. And whether you like it or not, they say, oh, don't talk about this, don't talk about that, in lodge meetings, etc. You will get people gathering together in small groups, and they will talk about their particular business, be it police work, be it old boy stuff at school, or in this case, you know, Oxford University, etc. There will be people in there. And if you were going to sit down with me and I was choosing somebody for a job, and I'm a Mason and I know the man on the left is a Mason and the man on the right isn't a Mason, then my preference is going to be for the Mason, because I believe I know what he's like in terms of what he's been through, is what I've been through, etc. So there is a preference in there, whether that's you know, smacks in business or in whatever practice that you take on. So, yeah, I think there is a case of that. When I say a police lodge, I've attended a police lodge in southeast London, and I was told in that police lodge not to go to certain lodges in Croydon, because they knew there was a lot of rotten guys in those lodges in Croydon. And if I wanted to avoid any sort of rubbing shoulders with any sort of London's underworld criminals, then don't go to lodges in Croydon.
Oh, crikey. Well, I mean, yeah, so it's interesting that even your experience in Freemasonry indicates that there might be some, you know, use of the secrecy provided by Freemasonry for crime. But anyway, if you were to say, have one, you know, thing to say to someone who was about to think about, anyway, joining Freemasonry, Ian, what would that be?
What, if I was somebody going in, if I wanted to...
Yeah, if someone is thinking of joining Freemasonry, what would be your sort of, you know, if you were able to just give them one, either a word of warning or else encouragement, whatever, that they probably wouldn't be getting from the Masons themselves?
I would give them that word of warning that what they're about to do and what obligation that they're going to take on is going to affect their very life from that moment onwards, and they should consider it very, very deeply, that what they're going to do is going to be given obligation that they cannot get out of for their life. Now, I've told you before, and other people, and I've seen it on the internet, is that the obligation traditionally is to have your life terminated in several ways, depending on which degree you're in. But the sentence at the end of all this macabre way of putting you to death. As you say, nobody's going to actually do that. But what they actually do in the wording and afterwards is that if you do leave, if you are break any of our rules, etc., then you are to be considered a pariah, an unworthy person, unfit to be a member of any society. So as far as they're concerned, they would not want you to succeed in any other life after you've left Freemasonry. And I came across people who I knew were Freemasons, and they didn't know that I was an ex-Freemason, but after some inquiries, etc., I got the distinct impression that they knew that I was, and suddenly I became somebody not to speak to. Suddenly I became an unworthy person.
You know what, it strikes me, it sounds a little bit only
2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, this sounds something almost like childish about it, Ian.
If it was childish, that would be fine. We can deal with childish things, but we're talking about some people's lives.
Yeah,
my particular life and the way I go about it. I wanted to expose this and put people into, you know, give the balanced view, if you like. And I approached several people, got to quite successful with one BBC chap who wanted to do it. We had parted on great good company on a Thursday night after I'd seen him on the South Coast, only for a phone call on Monday morning for him to withdraw completely and say that he'd been threatened that his very livelihood, his job, etc., would have been completely thrown out had he continued to stay in contact with me and produce the film that we wanted to produce.
Well, that's amazing. And it helps to explain why we see so little about Freemasonry. And what we do see seems to be very unbalanced, in fact, almost like a Masonic advert on Sky TV, on our TV screens. Ian, you did actually get a call after you'd left Freemasonry to rejoin the army, didn't you?
Absolutely. I rejoined. I have continued in my army career. I was promoted. I've been to operational theatres in Bosnia, Kosovo, Sierra Leone, and Iraq, and I made quite a success of that. And I was very, very grateful for the people who took the opportunity and took the decision to allow me to do that. As you quite rightly, you've known me for quite a few years, but I have been quite concerned and worried about that for many, many years.
So we worried about what?
The retribution that will come my way.
Right.
If you know, somebody within the Masonic world, etc., decided to expose, he's not very good, he's an ex-Mason, you know, we don't like him, and spread things around that I wasn't a worthy character.
Yeah, well, I think it's actually very brave of you to come out, Ian, and explain some of the inner secrets of Freemasonry and just how cruel they can be to people like yourself who just say, well, I've had enough of this, for whatever reason, whether it's by choice or whether you're forced out. There certainly is a life out of Freemasonry, whatever they might be trying to tell you. So anyway, Ian, I'd just like to thank you very much for joining us on Dialect and for doing a review.
I'm pleased to do this review for you, but my point about this whole thing was it should be balanced. It's more of an advert. It might attract people because they want to be part of that, part of those secrets. But to condemn others who have left for various reasons and finding out about them at a later on and then deciding that they would go to several lengths to disparage their characters, etc., it is just wrong. And I feel very, very sorry for those people who've left Freemasonry, and I've met quite a few of them. I've met quite a few of them in those programs that we've been seeing as well. And I just think if the balanced view was out there, a lot more people would think a lot more seriously about whether to join this. But I do emphasise that there's 97.8% of the male population in England who are not Freemasons. And one of the things that I was, when I finished and carried on my Christian faith, etc., one of the things that was always told me all the time is that not everybody's a Freemason. And there are lots of other good people out there, and there are lots of other good people out there who've been very, very good to me.
Okay, Ian Matteson, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and download the podcast the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Shell Coe from Keogh Films, just won a BAFTA award, And if you want to contact Shell at Keo Films about the In Work Poverty series, where work is no longer a way out of poverty, you can call her on 07465 733 735. That's 07465 733 735. Or email shell.co, C-O-E, at keofilms, keofilms.com. That's shell.co at keofilms.com. Arabella Wynne Hughes, and also Ian Mattison, former Freemason. And to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or email prsc.org.uk. If you want to volunteer, well, Bristol Volunteer Centre is now closed. It was opened in 1966 but closed this month. But you can go to the national volunteering website do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Walk on through, there ain't no love, no use.